very worried about my nation. I feel it is becoming a nation which is not American.
We essentially are destabilizing what is, or has been, one of the most successful democracies in the world.
What people like to eat, people eat. And so what we're doing is we're feeding the end of our democracy. That's what it seems like.
Just about a year ago, rioters stormed the U.S. Capitol. Their actions that day were extreme, but the vast majority were not members of far-right extremist groups. Instead, they're part of a much larger movement, one that falsely believes the election was stolen. About 1 in 4 Americans agree with that incorrect premise, and about 1 in 10 say the use of force to restore former President Trump to the White House is justified. That's according to recent surveys from the Chicago Project on Security and Threats at the University of Chicago. They also found that only 13% of those arrested in relation to the insurrection were part of militias or other extremist groups. Even so, those groups have helped sow conspiracy theories and turn those extreme ideas into violent action. After the break, we'll dive into the far-right extremism that fueled the insurrection, something many of you are concerned about. I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A Podcast. Remember, to join future conversations, download our 1A Vox Pop app and leave us a voicemail. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're talking about far-right extremism and the insurrection. Joining us from Chicago, Illinois, is Robert Pape. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, where he directs the Chicago Project on Security and Threats. Professor Pape, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me, Jen.
And with us from Los Angeles is Heather Williams. She's a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation, which is a nonpartisan global policy think tank. She's also a former member of the intelligence community. She worked at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Heather, welcome.
Thank you, and hello.
And finally, based out of Boise, Idaho, we have Heath Druzan. He's the host and creator of a new podcast, Extremely American. It investigates militias and other far-right groups. Heath, welcome back.
Great to be here. Thanks, Jen.
So Heath, let's start with that day. Most of the people arrested weren't part of far-right extremist groups, but what role did those groups play in planning the insurrection?
Yeah, that's right. Most of the people at the Capitol appear to have been unaffiliated. But there were members of groups there, and they kind of played an outsized role. Some of the more serious charges we saw were against members of a national militia movement called the Oath Keepers. And there were also a lot of folks from a group called the Proud Boys, which I wouldn't say is a militia, but it's certainly a militia-adjacent group. So they were a small minority of the people there. But what you saw with some of the folks, especially the Oath Keepers, was they're alleged to have had a very coordinated effort. So you had folks who were in body armor. They had communications. They had walkie-talkies. And they seemed to maybe have a plan. And that's kind of why that they keep coming up. Because you see them kind of there's video of these guys where they've all got a hand on each other's shoulders, like they're going in a coordinated effort into the Capitol, and that they've kind of got an objective, as opposed to the sort of more random violence that you often saw with a lot of the folks there. So they did play a small role in the actual riot, But, you know, if you follow them, if you follow them on some of the sort of alternative social media, because a lot of them have been kicked off, you'll see that that they've been posting a lot of that misinformation that you alluded to for a long time, and they continue to do it. And obviously, that fed into a lot of the anger that was pushing the folks who did storm the Capitol.
Now, people may be familiar with a few of these groups, as you mentioned, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters. But give us a quick rundown of who they are and any other groups we should be talking about in relation to January 6th.
Well, two of the biggest militias in the country are the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters. And both of them aren't so much single militias as a militia movement with chapters in pretty much every state in the country. And the Proud Boys also are a national movement. Now, the Proud Boys are, as I said, they're less of a militia and more of a they're more of this sort of far right. They call themselves Western chauvinist group. Certainly a lot of them have expressed racist and homophobic ideas as well. Now, the Three Percenters and Oath Keepers are more sort of traditional militias in that they're very skeptical of the government. They do a lot of weapons training, and they talk a lot about basically being prepared in case the government oversteps what they see as the bounds of constitutionality and becomes tyrannical, which is a word that which they use a lot. So these two groups, the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters, they've been very successful in recent years at recruiting and opening chapters around the country. And as anti-government sentiment is built in the country, they've really been able to capitalize on that and get new members. And the pandemic has sort of supercharged that. You know, there's obviously a lot of conspiracies around that, a lot of dissatisfaction with the government among certain circles, especially on the far right. And that does seem to be pushing people to these groups and to be more open to, you know, training with weapons and talking more openly about conflict with the government.
Now, Professor Pape, your team did a demographic survey of the 700 or so people who have been arrested in relation to the insurrection. And as we said, only 13% were part of extremist groups like the ones we just described. If they weren't part of these groups, what motivated their actions?
Overwhelmingly, it is support to keep Donald Trump as president, even as we all know, the overwhelming certification of the congressional of our vote went for Joe Biden. So what happened is, when you read their court documents, you'll see that over and over and over again, they talk about why they came to Washington, D.C. They came in response to Trump's tweets to come. They say why they stormed the Capitol. They say they stormed the Capitol because Donald Trump told them to. They're following the orders of their president, as they say. And they are doing it not just to trespass, not just to get into the Capitol, but they are doing it for a key core political motive, which is to stop the certification of the presidency for Joe Biden. And to that would mean then that Donald Trump would remain president of the United States. So this was a key effort to essentially overturn the number one constitutional process we have in our country, which is a transfer of power. And that was meant to stop, the storm was meant to stop that transfer of power. So there are, when you might say, well, maybe you would look in the court documents and think that there would be other motives here. This is just head and shoulders the motive that they voice, and it's voiced by about half of them. So they're not, it's not like they're keeping it secret, so to speak.
Heather, there are two main terms that the federal government uses to describe domestic extremism. What are those?
Yes, so the government has introduced a new set of terms to describe this far-right movement and domestic terrorism. Domestic terrorism can obviously be broader than just the far-right, and all of those terms are kind of in this batch. But the largest two elements of the domestic terrorism movements we see in the United States are those that are racially and ethnically motivated, or racially and ethnically motivated violent extremism. RMV is the government's acronym. And that, I think, we can generally think about as white supremacy and related tenets. And then anti-government or anti-authority extremists. And the largest group in that is militia violent extremists, who we've already heard some examples presented in the program today.
And which did we see on January 6th, or was it both?
I think there are elements of both. I think on January 6th, clearly some of the organizational elements came from groups that are more part of that militia violent extremist movement. But, you know, there are also Confederate flags brought to the Capitol on January 6th. And I think there are certainly there are individuals who were part of the protests and who have arrested and been in court and talked about how they are white supremacist or otherwise could have broadcast these racial or ethnic extremist views.
Well, one of you tweeted this, extremism didn't fuel this. It's the long-term defunding of basic government services that have led to many feeling abandoned and afraid of how they will survive. Now, Professor Pape, what did your study of the people arrested in relation to January 6th uncover about who those people are, details like their economic status or where they're from?
The number one thing to know is that they are part of mainstream America, not coming from the fringe. So we're used to thinking about right-wing extremism coming from the fringe, just part of militia groups or extremist groups. And in fact, when you look at who has been arrested by the FBI and law enforcement for, say, the last 5 or 10 years for committing violent acts, that is right-wing people committing violent acts, they do fit that profile. That is, half of them about are members of militia groups, as you just heard from Heather. That's not what we see on January 6th. What we see on January 6th is coming from mainstream America. Over half of the 700 who have been arrested are business owners and from white-collar backgrounds, doctors, lawyers, accountants, attorneys, managers. They are overwhelmingly, this is very different than we're used to seeing from the right wing. So when we see right wing violent offenders, we're used to thinking of them as 25% unemployed or a third unemployed. Here, about 7% were unemployed at the time of January 6th, which is nearly the national average. When we look at all kinds of other indicators, their college education, their criminal record backgrounds, what you see is a profile of who of the January 6th insurrectionists that looks very much like mainstream America on factor after factor after factor.
Well, Heath, over the past year, you spent time with domestic militias, including the Pennsylvania Volunteer Militia and its leader, Christian Yuengling. Let's listen to a moment from episode one of your podcast, Extremely American. And we just want to give folks a heads up in the clip. You're at a shooting range, so we will hear some gunshots.
This drill is called 1R1. That stands for one shot, reload, one shot. The men have to quickly draw their pistol, shoot, reload, and shoot again, all while staying on target. Yuengling is not impressed with what he sees.
He missed what he was aiming at there. You know what I mean? If that was a headshot, he missed the dude's head.
The fictional human who still has a head is meant to be an attacker.
Why did you decide it was important to investigate militias in the insurrection's aftermath, Heath?
Well, the reason that I thought it was really relevant right now is because I've actually, even before the insurrection, I've been covering them, and I've noticed that they've been becoming a lot more visible in the community, and maybe more importantly, I've seen that they've become much more political. Whereas, you know, when the militia movement really got going in the 1990s in the U.S., you had these groups that really were kind of content to train in the woods and basically be in the shadows. Now, it didn't mean that they weren't dangerous, obviously, but they definitely were a lot less visible. The groups I've been seeing, especially being based in Idaho, they have more and more been involved in politics. A lot of them have become mainstays at state houses, and some of them are even running for election themselves and actually winning election. So what you're seeing is that, you know, we keep hearing the word mainstream, and I think that is really important, because some of these groups are really being embraced by party politics. A lot of folks from these movements are running with the full blessing of local GOPs. And, you know, they're taking seats in state houses, and they're certainly influencing policy now. So when I started seeing that happen, and I started seeing mainstream politicians sort of embrace them and even share a stage with them and appear in their campaign videos, I thought, you know what, this is, you know, this is more than a fringe movement right now. You know, a fringe movement is not winning office. So, So, you know, I started watching even before January 6th. And when January 6th happened, I was like, okay, so, you know, this is starting to be kind of vital on a lot of different fronts because they're influencing policy and they're influencing people's behavior on a national scale.
We got this tweet from Kimberly who says, I would like to know just what rights these militia groups feel are taken away. The U.S. has more rights than most countries in the world. Why are they so afraid of religion and people of color? They are cowards. Heath, what did you learn from spending time with these groups?
So, you know, these groups, as you might imagine, being groups that oppose strong central authority, they don't necessarily agree on everything. And a lot of these groups have very different ideas. Some of them even hate each other. There are two things that they coalesce around. The really big one is gun rights. They see the Second Amendment as absolute, and pretty much any kind of restriction on gun rights as unconstitutional. And the reason that's so important to them is that they feel that having weapons is basically a hedge against the government overstepping their bounds. So they believe if the people are unarmed, then the government will become tyrannical. And they see their right to bear arms as fundamental to basically keeping their freedoms, up to and including potentially having a violent conflict with the government if necessary. And the other thing they coalesce around is this really absolutist idea about the federal government's powers basically being limited to almost nothing, basically just national defense. Now, it's a view that's pretty out of step with most constitutional scholars, even conservative ones. But, you know, that's something that is very important to them, that they think the federal government has become way too big and has way too much of a role in our lives. So these groups will disagree on a lot, but those two fundamental things drive them, and they see any sort of step over what they see as, you know, constitutionality as a real red line.
Heather, is domestic extremism growing in the United States? How do we even measure that?
I think that it is, and there are a number of indicators that suggest that it is. So, one, we see more attacks by far-right extremists in the United States in the last 5 years. Those have surpassed attacks by Islamic extremists, both in frequency and the number of casualties caused. We see more investigations, more arrests by the FBI for domestic extremist reasons. And I think it's a little bit more difficult to quantitate what we see online, but I think we certainly, you know, feels like there's an increasing volume of material of that orientation in online spaces and being published.
It's been a year since the insurrection, and we're discussing the domestic extremism that ignited that moment and remains today. A reminder to have your questions answered on future topics or just to let us know what you think, tweet us at 1A. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Now let's get back to our conversation about the extremism that fueled the insurrection and where that movement is today. We're getting a lot of questions about media. Tanner tweeted, I think the reason why right-wing extremism has become more mainstream is because of right-wing media. Until we can fix right-wing media, this is only going to get worse. And Alex tweeted, there's a militant-to-mainstream info pipeline that feeds talking points from the far alt-right to blogs to InfoWars, Breitbart, and One America News, and finally to Fox, where they are legitimized for the mainstream right. And Heather, speak more specifically about the role media, both social media and other media, are playing into what we're seeing right now.
Yes, I think those are certainly relevant factors. I mean, extremism exists on a spectrum, and extreme movements are always trying to get more of their extreme ideas or the antecedents to those into the mainstream. So it's less work for them to pull people to the farther end of that spectrum and to violent action. I think social media is where that is the most easy to do. You know, you sort of see the most elastic movements. And I think in addition to the emergence of alt tech platforms or alternative technology platforms where extremists have gone after they have been deplatformed by the mainstream platforms, what we found in our research is there is still plenty of explicitly racist or xenophobic or otherwise discriminatory material on a mainstream platform. It's still fairly easy to build your own echo chamber, or sometimes even to be pushed further into that echo chamber through the platform's own algorithms on social media. One thing I think is interesting to look at in the way that some more right-oriented media sources have been talking about extremism is how often they talk about Antifa and left movements, which are so much smaller than the far-right movements and generally much less violent.
David emailed, "I see fascism coming. I was born in the mid-1950s. When I was in school, there was a feeling that things were getting better. We had episodes of evil in our history, but the trend was toward more equality and justice for all. Now it's rather frightening to me that in my older years, the country seems to be drifting toward less equality, more racism, more right-wing bullying toward what feels like a fascist state." Heather, I want to redirect our attention for a moment and talk about how this extremism is being countered. What governmental agency is responsible for countering domestic extremism?
Well, there's no single government agency responsible for this. I don't want to imply that the government isn't doing things. The government is doing quite a lot. So the FBI elevated domestic terrorism in its internal rankings of national security threats. They did that in 2020 in response to the increasing numbers of violent attacks they saw in 2018 and 2019. And that means more resources, more agents, more investigations focused on domestic terrorism and extremism that is going to result in crimes. And that is their responsibility. So if we're talking about illegal activity, violent extremism, the FBI is responsible. The White House also released a national strategy for domestic terrorism. The Pentagon commissioned a working group to study the issue, and they've updated the Department of Defense's policies on extremism and advanced a host of other measures to understand the problem and to try to ensure that extremists can't succeed in the military and can't infiltrate the military. And the Department of Homeland Security has reoriented their counter-violent extremism efforts, and they've taken a new public health-related approach. And that last one is really important, I think, to build kind of the public resilience we need to far-right extremism, essentially defend the mainstream from extremist attempts to co-opt it. But those efforts are still very nascent, and that's really not the bulk of what the Department of Homeland Security does. So I think it will be interesting to see if they have the kind of flexibility to rise to the challenge of that task, or whether there needs to be some other part of the government that gets involved.
Well, earlier this week, I spoke to Tom Manger. He's the new Capitol Police Chief. And I asked him if his officers were prepared for another riot like the one that happened on January 6th.
I'm confident that today, if we had a big event like that, that not only would we have the equipment, the training, all that's in place already, but that we have a plan in place to get additional people in from our regional partners, that we would have adequate staffing to deal with whatever occurred.
At the same time, Manger says he needs 400 more officers, and morale is low because of staffing shortages and a dramatically increased workload. Officers dealt with more than 9,000 threats to lawmakers last year. That's up from 900 in 2016. You can find that conversation at the1a.org. But I would love to hear from all of you as we just wrap up in these final minutes, a year after January 6th. How at risk are we for more political violence like we saw a year ago? Heath?
Unfortunately, I think we're at great risk and probably greater risk than we were before. I don't know that we're going to see something like January 6th again, just because there's been so many people arrested, and I think that sort of dampened the fervor for that. But there's a lot of people who are very worried about more localized violence, and the temperature has certainly been rising out there as far as rhetoric. You know, I was in Michigan where there was a alleged plot to kidnap the governor there. And the folks in the AG's office there are extremely worried about more such threats. So,
Professor Pape, briefly from you, we have just a few seconds here.
Yes, we're moving into a tinderbox in the 2022 election season. We have a massive dry kindling in the 21 million who have insurrectionist sentiments in the country that can be touched off by a spark or a lightning strike. We can't predict the spark or lightning strike, but what we can see is this mass of dry kindling that can be touched off, much like a wildfire, and we're moving into many contentious state elections where those sparks could fly.
Heather, I'll give you the last word here very briefly.
I think that low-level instability for a prolonged period is a very real threat.
That's Heather Williams. She's a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. That's a nonpartisan global policy think tank. She's also a former member of the intelligence community who worked at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Also with us today, Robert Pape, a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He directs the Chicago Project on Security and Threats. We were also joined by Heath Druzin, the host and creator of the new podcast, Extremely American. It investigates militias and other far-right groups. Thanks to you all. Today's producer was Avery J.C. Kleinman. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.